Your life did not revolve around the RAF in Gibraltar, so tell me a little bit about that.
Well, first thing I can remember is, well, comparing it with when I've been back from a holiday. I first made my way down to Main Street, and how did we get there? The first thing I saw was Winston Churchill Avenue, Glamis Estate. Now that consisted of huts, missing huts and things like that, where ordinary people lived. There were a few blocks of flats up against the rock. I can't remember exactly the name of that estate. But comparing it, you see, I couldn't really compare anything until I went back for my holiday in 1995, and I could see how it had changed. All those huts had gone. It was giant blocks of flats and an overpass, a footbridge, which is where the IRA murdered this person, or what happened. It was in the newspaper. And then you came to the three-way junction. Now that one road, the right-hand road, went round to Waterport. The middle road went up and over the Waterport Road, across an iron bridge, which is still there, and down Lionmoor Road. The left-hand road went down under the iron bridge and out into Waterport Market, where the buses, the old Spanish buses, used to stop. Blue and cream, with a door at the back in the middle, and you sort of climbed up a sort of staircase and two steps, rather like the back of a gypsy caravan. And the fare was, I think it was penny or tuppence or something to the border. Or you could go by taxi for threepence. Shocking old taxis, very upright looking things that looks as if they'd stepped out of the era of Charles Dickens, or a little bit more recent than that, of course. But
Were they like London taxis, old
oh
London?
no, much older than that, very upright, you know. Mind you, yes, probably the old London, very old London taxis were, but of course that was the. I think they were something out of the 1920s, the 1930s, you know.
It's a place on the running board where they put the luggage next to the
That's it,
cab.
yeah, all that sort of thing. I probably had those, I never travelled in one, but after that, the buses used to stop outside Casemate Square, that used to be the army camp, but is no more. It's now a very plush square with restaurants and so on. They do have the Ceremony of the Keys there twice a year, and the last time I went to Gibraltar, I was very privileged to be able to attend, and very enjoyed it very much. And a friend of mine who was also in the RAF at the same time as I, but haven't been able to contact since, went with me because he was living in Gibraltar at the time. He went back there and settled there. Then you had to go up Main Street and avoid the buses and so on. It was just a single track road, and everybody sort of clambered out of the way when they heard something coming. You got up the Roman Catholic Cathedral, and then beyond that, it was very sort of dull, old black walls and houses and so on. Then you got to past Library Street and went down to Cathedral Square. Then that's where you could see the back, the east end of the Holy Trinity Cathedral. Then you went down further past the Medical Hall, the Cowper Institute on the left, and King's Chapel and the Governor's Residence on the right, and the Guardhouse opposite. Then you passed Wesley House. When you came down to Southport Gates, there was a customs building there. Then you get out of the city centre, that's through Southport Gates, and the Charles V Wall goes down to there and goes right up to the top of the rock. Then after that, you went down to, if you were round to the right, you went down to the dockyard, which has long since closed. If you went straight on and to the right, you went down the lower road to Rosia, which is a very pleasant suburb, Gibraltar. And of course, I think that's going to be the Chelsea of Gibraltar, because the whole lot has been rebuilt since I was there. In fact, when I was last there, about 3 or 4 years ago. They were still, it was still a sea of cranes. My friend lived in tower buildings. That's long since gone. And the Cumberland House behind that has gone. It was all being rebuilt. In fact, Bill, a friend of mine who I've kept up with, lived at a flat in Cumberland House, which is still there. After the Rosier, it sort of, the road sort of petered out. You went to Camp Bay and Little Bay. But now there's a tunnel that takes it through to Europa Point. From the Queen's Cinema, which is south of Southport Gates, if you were to go up the hill past the Rock Hotel and the casino, which is now there, you would eventually go to Europa Point, which is said to be the southernmost point in Europe. Well, it's not. Tarifa is about 2 kilometres further south. That's Tarifa in Spain. But those old buses used to... Well, mind you, the buses that I was talking about just now are the Spanish ones that took you across the airport to La Linea. You had to go across the airports, the airstrips, the only place in the world where the traffic actually crosses the runway until an aircraft is due, and then they turn the lights red and put the barrier down, and all the donkey carts used to sort of clear out of the way, and then the aircraft came in, then the barriers went up again. Donkey carts have long since disappeared. But the town buses were our old Bedfords and one or two others. The main door on the left was sealed shut. The emergency exit on the right, you had to swing it outwards and hope that nobody would be standing there, because they would get knocked for six. Because that was the actual entrance, because the, you know, Gibraltar, rather than drive on the left and have an awkward change at the border, decided to adopt a right-hand rule of the road, which was a very wise move. And
well, that's a very good description from memory. That's a walk around Gibraltar. Thank you very much. That's great. So tell me about the sort of things that you did in your spare time then.
Well, I joined I was a member of the 8th Gibraltar Air Scout Troop, because I was a scout in 32nd Beckenham, Penge Baptist, and I had my uniform sent out to me. But I had to obtain a new, what they call the neckerchief, because ours was blue and white, and the Gibraltar one was light blue and dark blue. Called the 8th Gibraltar. We used to meet in a hut near South Barracks, which has since become St. Joseph's School. Well, the hut has long since been demolished. And last time I went where I went to look see it was, they had never built anything in its place. And the idea was to demolish it and build something else, but they never did. But we moved down to a set of garages, one of which had been, or two of which had been converted into our headquarters. And I went back there for my holiday. I couldn't even find that. It's being built up. The lovely plant, a wisteria, I believe, which was grown over a wall, has long since disappeared and become a bus shelter. And that's just north of what is now Jumper's building. There was a great big rather seedy-looking block of flats there. That's been demolished and rebuilt, and it's called the Jumper's Building. And I think it was something to do with the Captain Jumper. I'm not sure. But just outside is a rather modern-looking steel statue of St. George and the Dragon, St. George on his horse. A lot of the dockyard has been taken over by shops, and it's Iceland there in one of the buildings. Very seedy looking, but it sufficed. What else can I remember? Yes, Gibraltar Television. Well, that didn't come in until I was just about to come home, and you could see the mast near Windmill Hill. But they are not allowed to use television frequencies in Gibraltar because of the military. So what they do is they bounce everything off a satellite, and everybody's got satellite dishes. So what happens is it goes straight up to the satellite and comes straight down again. And of course, they're going to use satellite frequencies, which of course is possible.
What was it like, Gibraltar television?
Black and white.
In Spanish or English?
A bit of each. I tell you one thing. I was walking home from the Methodist Church one day, and there was a shop that sold television sets because they were beginning to come in. And there was a very snowy black and white picture of Cliff Mitchellmore. And the subtitle came up, or heading, Tonight, BBC One. Oh no, BBC Tonight. It was a direct transmission from the UK, because the month was May, and May is the month of sporadic E. Sporadic E being a movement in the clouds, or the stratosphere, that causes television signals to bend. You usually go straight out in a straight line. Well, this touches the sporadic E and it bends, and it came down in Gibraltar, more or less. And we were able to see this programme, and very, very snowy. But, of course, it's all satellite now. In fact, friends of mine, they watch Coronation Street. I think it's Coronation Street at 8:30. But, of course, it's 7:30 here. But, of course, you can get all the BBC programmes, BBC 1, 2, 3, 4 and all the others, via satellite. So it's absolutely completely different. But it gave me the idea of how technology has developed over the years. From that's when I saw that very snowy first effort kind of picture of Cliff Mitchellmore, BBC television, direct UK broadcast, being bent by the clouds, to what we have today, when everybody watches everything on satellite an hour later.
Yes. So what did you, I mean, you talked about, you know, going to Main Street and things. What did you used to do in your spare time? Hang on a minute, let's just go back a bit. You talked about the Scouts. So what did you do? Tell me a little bit about what you do. What did you do in the Scouts?
Well, we went to the Scout meeting every evening, once a week. And there was a camp, which I didn't actually go on. I could have taken some leave and gone there, but I didn't really like the idea. I'd rather the camp was for my own troop here. But and we used to go round to Julie's. Let's go to Julie's. Julie's, what was that? So I went, and we walked past the South Barracks and down the side, and there was a dingy little shop with a 40-watt bulb about every five or six metres, and we used to have Spanish omelette. But if anybody knew how to make a Spanish omelette, Julie did. They were absolutely marvellous, and we went down there every week after the Scout meeting. And I came out one evening, and I happened to look up into the sky, and I could see something moving. It turned out to be the Saturnoon. It was apparently a balloon which they sent up into space, into orbit. And they called it the Saturnoon, and I actually saw it with the naked eye. That was every, say, Friday evening we did that, because I couldn't do one Friday and three, or two Fridays and three, because one, I had to get back to go on night duty. The other one, I was on the evening duty. The other two, I was free. I also joined, of course, the Methodist Church and the fellowship evening. We did actually go out there. I went to... Oh, we had to look round SS Canistio, I think it was. And we were allowed on board, and we were taken on a tour of the ship.
So was this a British Navy ship or Spanish?
I don't know. American, I think.
Or American, or, yes.
Possible. Mm. It was called Canistio, but what exactly what the initials
were.
When
was this? What date was that, roughly? Was that in 59?
Around about 59, yes. And we went to Cable and Wireless to see their communication centre. It was a lovely brass switches and polished wood and all that. It looked as if it stepped straight out of the Victorian era compared with what we had. But it served, and I also remember...
And what were Cable and Wireless? Well, you weren't connected then?
No.
And what were they up to, doing commercial work?
Oh, they did commercial work, and I think it was the commercial version of what we did. And I was only there for one evening, and I don't even know where it is now. I don't think Cable and Wireless exists now.
You were a Methodist, that was your religion?
Baptist, sorry.
But it wasn't a Baptist church, so you went to the Methodist.
We all went to the Methodist.
Yeah. When we say we, who was we?
Everybody who was a nonconformist. Baptist. You see, PMUB on the RAF used to be Presbyterian Methodist United Board. United Board was everybody else. The Methodists were probably, they actually were responsible for the running of it. The Presbyterian Church only exists in Scotland nowadays because it combined with what we know nowadays as the United Reformed Church. Now, Penge Congregational Church, where I used to live, never changed, and it is still Penge Congregational Church. Here, it's Whitstable United Reformed, because the Congregationalists and the Presbyterians joined. There's a church in Herne Bay, which is URC Methodist, and they've sort of joined up, and they use the same building.
And it's all these different churches, slight derivations on Church of England, is that what they are?
Oh, yes. Well, the nonconformist churches are hymn sandwiches. You have a hymn and a prayer and a reading and another hymn, then another prayer and then another hymn, then you get the offertory, and then they take the plate round and go forward, and then there's no liturgy in it. And I never thought I would become an Anglo-Catholic, which is the English version of Rome. But I can go and worship in Our Lady Immaculate Cathedral in Gibraltar and Our Lady, Lady the Crown quite easily now.
Are you talking about High Church?
High, yes.
Mm. What was it that attracted you to being a Baptist rather than just staying in normal old Church of England then?
Because I was brought up as a Baptist. You see, my mother's family were Baptists, my father's. But unbeknown to me, after I'd been confirmed in 1970, I was coming home with my aunt in the car. She said, "Mike, you know that you've put our family, the Cook family, back on its original footing. We were always Church of England, Anglican." But of course, it was in the days when the Anglican Church was, well, virtually dead from the neck up, and nothing happened, that my grandmother went to hear Charles Haddon Spurgeon preach. He swept her off her feet and she joined the Baptists. And because I've put our family back into the Anglican, but of course, which branch? And I found that the Anglo-Catholic, the High Church, was me. And I thought, well, where have I been hiding all these years?
And why? Tell me why.
It was given to me. God gave it to me. He said, "That's your niche." And I'm very glad I did. And of course, I go to Walsingham now.
Because also of the sort of the amount of more sacred music?
Well, there is that about it as well. But you do get a lot of liturgy where people can join in. Whereas at the Baptist church, if you go to sleep in the back row, nobody will notice, you see, because there's nothing to join in except the Lord's Prayer and sing the hymns. And that was it. There just wasn't any. It seems I've been talked down to, you know.
In the Baptist?
Primary school, yes.
Yes.
I would recommend it for anybody, any new person wanting to find the Lord, go to a Baptist church and they'll teach you very gently and sort of tell you about it. And then if you want to branch out a bit, then do so. I did get some experience at the Anglican church when I joined our local parish church choir when I was 10. but I was still essentially Baptist, and it wasn't until I went back after the RAF, went back as assistant organist for a couple of years, and then I thought, well, I don't like this, so I got a job at a Baptist church, and it was that that drove me into the Anglican, because when I was invited to go to a cathedral as an assistant organist among one of our lecturers, I was only there for a couple of years.
What, when was that?
Southwark. It was in 1965, 66. That I realised that I wanted to be an Anglican. And I was then confirmed. But I think that was the move that put me in. Actually, I stopped being a wanderer and came home, so to speak.
What a fantastic place for it to happen in Southwark Cathedral. So beautiful. That's very interesting, Michael.
Yeah.
And it's important to say all this because it is part of who you are.
Well, who I am, yes.
Yeah.
And I will not leave the church. The church is my anchorage. You know, it's my filling station every Sunday morning and go to, well, Eucharist as we call it. I know I play the organ round at All Saints and I've been there since 1980 as their organist, but I'm still part of the church. I'm not just a person that goes in and does plays the organ as a job and is never seen from Sunday to Sunday. Yesterday we had the cameo, come and meet each other, meal. We have it every Monday. It's just cakes and biscuits and cups of tea and things. I'm always there. We've got what they call the Novena this week. It's the 9 days between the Ascension and Pentecost, and the Bishop of Dover, Trevor, wants us to pray each day, and we have service every day doing something different. We had a fun service the other day. I didn't go to that, but we've got... there's one tonight, but I will be going tomorrow. There's a meditative reflection. Then there's always the Thursday Eucharist, which I go to at 10 o'clock. I don't play for that, I just go. It's rather nice to go to something and not have to worry about what key the next hymn's going to be in. And I can concentrate on what I'm doing. Then Friday is something else, then Saturday, and then it's Whit Sunday on Sunday. So at the end of the...
Of course. Mm. Let's just go back a minute to Gibraltar.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's quite interesting is that, I mean, at that period of time, I mean, in the late 50s, 60s, most people did have a religion. If you had to write on your form, what's your religion? Most people had one.
Oh, a lot
Whereas
of us...
Whereas now, a lot of people don't. But what do you think about, I mean, were your contemporaries, who were they and what sort of religion did they have?
Well, the people I was with in my room didn't go to church at all.
Didn't go to church?
No. I think Tony Norton was, he was the most interested one. Well, I had Brian Smith in the room next door, who was a very staunch Christian and still is, and I still keep up with him. In fact, he was one of the people I'm trying to contact about giving an interview. He lives in Bristol.
That's right. But how, I hope you don't mind me asking this, but how do you find out about whether people's inclination is to church? How do you establish that?
I don't say, brother, are you saved? It's enough to put anybody off. Being a Christian is not what you say or do, it's what you are. And they'll say something, that chap's got something I haven't got. And another way to do it is you get back after a weekend. Hello, Mike, have you had a good weekend? He says, what did you do? And I said, so-and-so. And of course, I always go to church on Sunday. But you've got in. They started it. They started the conversation. But people at work, just before I retired, they got really interested because I went on a course. And they just wanted to know all about it. And they gave me a lovely Easter egg. And he said, Easter means much more to you than it does us. Accept it with our love. It's a great thing, the size of a football, nearly.
You were in Gibraltar then, in your room with the other people who didn't go to church, how did you discover who was who?
Well, I noticed that they didn't. Well, services would have been on, they were still in bed or something like that. And of course I did say, well, I'm off to church now, but if they didn't want to go, then that was it. Nothing I could do. Well, there it is if you want it. But they noticed that I read the Bible each day and still do. I had notes, and probably somebody asked me about it. I didn't. You don't push it. You don't indoctrinate people. You just talk. It's like putting milk down for the cat. Put the food down for the cat. If the cat wants to eat it, all well and good. If it doesn't, there's nothing you can do. I've probably got a plate of something outside waiting for mine to come down from upstairs under the bed, where she now is, and eat it. But she'll probably come down at about 5 o'clock and have a bit. But it's being a Christian is what you are. You don't talk to anybody about it unless they ask you, or you do get an opportunity, do it and leave it at that. If they want to know, they'll do the talking. But I met my main friends in the church. Now I met Bill and Brian and a lot of others at the Methodist Church.
In Gibraltar?
In Gibraltar. That's where I made my friends with the capital F.
And were they from the RAF or were they from all over the place?
All over the place, yes. Now, Derek Nash was the choir master. He was an army corporal. He had... there's Brian, Bill, and we had a lot of people who came in from the Salvation Army, and they came to one of the services, either the morning or the evening, but not the other, because they had their own meeting at the Citadel in Engineer Lane.
And what the other thing about your being a Baptist? Were you a teetotaler?
Oh yes.
Always.
Yeah, not quite so much now because I do like a glass of wine with my dinner. I have that because it thins the blood and is good for blood pressure. Now I have a blood pressure problem nowadays because I have tablets for it. But they said wine is good for blood pressure and it's good for you. It's rather like eating a packet of aspirins. Eat the whole lot and you're dead. Eat one and you get rid of your headache. I have 250 millilitres maximum per day.
Is that? Little glass?
It's two little glasses.
But what was it like? I mean, I've interviewed few people who tell me raucous stories about National Service, and there was certainly an awful lot of drunkenness in Gibraltar when the ships used to come in on Main Street. I've heard these stories.
Well, probably I didn't see very much at all. I probably wasn't looking. Mind you, if you're sort of at sea for days and days and days and suddenly and you get thoroughly fed up with it and you sort of come into land, you just want to let your hair down. Well, I don't think I ever saw a drunk sailor. They probably sort of down a tide turning somewhere. But
so you didn't get stigmatised for being by other people?
Not at all, no. I did, I liked and still do a glass of wine. In fact, when we went to some friends of mine who were civilians, asked me if I'd like to go on holiday with them to Madrid by car. And of course we went on bumpy roads. And it was, oh dear, it took us all day to get, and we didn't even make it to Seville in a day. Nowadays you can do it in a couple of hours. And we stopped somewhere just outside for the night. No, we didn't. We did get to Seville, but we went out of the city to this motel for to stay the night. It was all right until we got to the road that goes down to Rota. It was built by the Americans, and Jim just opened up, and he was doing 100 kilometres an hour in the car. Well, of course, that's nothing today, but in those days, the cars at the time wouldn't go much faster than that, but you wouldn't know you were moving. It was a marvellous road, and now they're all like it, because when Spain joined the EU, paid for the Spanish roads to be rebuilt. And a little tiny road, I used to walk up from La Linea to get to the Queen of Spain's chair, is now a dirty great dual carriageway with lights down the middle. In fact, the coaches go that way when I go on some of the tours out of Gibraltar up to towards Granada and so on, and all the coaches go that way, unless we go to Seville. Then we go along the little windy road that goes up to San Roque, which is now a motorway. It's just changed out of all recognition.
Why did you start telling me? You started telling me that story because we were talking about drinking wine.
Well, when we got, whatever we had a glass of wine, and I had one as well. White wine. It was Spanish, and of course it helps the food. Well, I knew that right from the beginning. And I thought there was no harm in this. In fact, somebody I know turned water into wine at Cana in Galilee.
Was this the first time you'd had a glass of wine?
First time I'd had a glass of wine, and I liked it. But I didn't let it get the better of me. I just had a glass, and that was it. And I still do.
Was it your parents who were so strict then, and didn't want you to drink?
Well, my grandmother, really. I don't know whether she was or not secretly, but I've got some sherry glasses or liqueur glasses, which I believe came from her. But I was probably in her young days when she was sort of hounded by her parents. You know, Victorian, you drink is a sin. And you still get some narrow-minded people today who says it's not the drink that's a sin, it's having too much of it. I go back to the bottle of aspirin. You've got a headache, you take an aspirin and it gets rid of it. And they say it's good for the heart and other things. But take the whole jolly packet in one go. You might as well arrange your funeral now before you do, because you'll need it.
Yes, that's true. Michael, but I think a lot of people, have a glass of wine and then want another one.
Yeah, that's the temptation. Well, I have never been tempted like that, and I never will be, because I won't take any notice. I will have, that is the limit. It's part of the meal.
So do you find yourself tempted in other ways then? I mean, is it all to do with temptation?
I think so, because everybody is tempted. You see, Satan has been put there by God to give us a point to go towards, to get away from him, and then realise that we are drifting and we ask him to bring us back. If white wasn't there, you couldn't draw a black and white picture. If black wasn't there, you couldn't draw a black and white picture. But if they're both there, you can draw a black and white picture with mixtures and bits to give all the delicate shades of grey in between. Temptation is the same way. We are drawn away. Oh, no, that'll be all right. Then you look back and I say, was it? No, I think, I'm sorry, Lord. And brings come back. It's drifting away and coming back is a bit difficult to explain, really, but it's there for a reason. Everything is there for a reason. And but to go back to Gibraltar and the wine, I wasn't exactly tempted. I was offered a glass of Coca-Cola with some rum in it, and it was jolly nice. And then later on one day I said, it'll have some rum in it. And I said, yeah. And I think they put too much. I wasn't actually out cold. I just felt awful, and I just sat in Wesley House canteen until it wore off. And I thought, that's taught me what drink does. If you have too much. So I remembered that. And nowadays I have, doctors say 250 millilitres is the limit per day for a male. I'm just about on, or just a fraction below, the number of units, recommended units, for a male. So.
Right.
But but it goes part of the food and it takes the food and helps digestion. When we have the goose at Christmas, always have wine with it, because otherwise you spend the afternoon with, oh dear, the wine takes the richness out.
Absolutely.
So it complements it.
So let's just go back to Gibraltar again. So we've talked about, just one more thing that we haven't, when we were talking about different denominations of religion. I mean, of course, Gibraltar is predominantly Catholic because of the Spanish. So did you ever go into the Catholic Church?
Oh, yes. Didn't go to a service. I played the organ in the Roman Catholic Cathedral once or twice. Not that the organ was very playable, because it wasn't. I have played it since then, because since it's been brought back here and rebuilt. It's much better now, but even now it's getting a little bit decrepit, because there are so many people who've got keys and get kids on it that don't know what they're doing. And of course, I'm only hoping that something's done there. But I must tell you a lovely incident at the Anglican Cathedral, because Miss Discombe asked me if I'd play for the 9:30 Eucharist each Sunday towards the end of my second year, because the RAF knew that I went to church, and they are not allowed to prevent you unless you're on operational duty. Say you're up in an aircraft and you can't do much about it then. But I used to go on duty on a Sunday morning till about eight till about 9:30, and then I left my uniform there, changed into civvies, and went round to the church, played for the service, went back, got into uniform again, just take a jacket and a shirt off and change, and then finish the duty and go back, and the same in the evening. Well, when I took over at the cathedral, and of course they let me go anyway, for the you're excused Sunday morning duty. That's okay. Well, because I was able to do it somehow, and of course the service was immediately before ours. Well, Miss Discombe, who was the organist, came up to me one day. She said, "Michael, do you know anything about how an organ works?" I said, "Yes, quite a lot. What do you want to know?" Well, she said, "I've got to, when the swell to great is on, that is a coupler that couples the second keyboard to the third, the top one. One note won't play, the key won't go down. Sometimes it goes up to the next note, sometimes it might go down to the note below." So I thought, sounds like a missile. So I went down to the cathedral one evening, started taking the console to pieces, put my hand in, took out a piece of wood about the size of a die, threw it over my shoulder and put the key back again, and all was well. Then I was playing the organ, and I thought, one of these notes, pedal notes, the bass notes, doesn't sound as loud as the others. Well, we had two bass stops, one loud one and one soft. So I pushed one in and played a scale on the other one, and all was well. So I then changed over, played a scale on the loud one, and one note didn't play at all. So I went round, found the pipe, and I took about 8 copies of the English hymnal words edition out of it. And the pipe played all the time, and it would not stop. Poor Miss Discombe had panicked. It was called in organ parlance a cipher. That's when a note won't stop sounding. So I took these books out. I found the little motor drive. It's a what they call book motors. They look like books and they blow up. And I adjusted the screw, turned it about a quarter of a turn to the left, and it plopped down and was all right from then on. "Oh, Michael," she said, "I'd forgotten all about that. Oh, thank you very much."
So she put all the books down
there. She put the books in the pipe to try and stop it.
How funny.